to cultivate both mindfulness, which is the bedrock of all Dharma practice, and wisdom, which is seeing the truth of things, experiencing what you are. Meditation at the same time offers us the opportunity to cultivate loving kindness toward ourselves in the midst of getting lost again and again and again. Again, those three questions: what are you aware of? Getting lost. How are you aware? Well, are you just noticing that's what is and coming back to presence? Or are you taking a detour and criticizing yourself and your meditation? As we get refined in our perceptions in this area, we naturally become more loving of ourselves. This meditation also teaches us to see our thoughts as separate from ourselves. Whereas in ordinary life, there's no distance between thought and self and identity. Meditation helps us see what we add, the how are you aware part. And most often, I should just say, very often, we gain the most from, quote, bad meditation. Because it's when meditation isn't going smoothly that we have the most opportunity to notice what our mind is doing, getting acquainted with our mind and its activity. Each time we notice that we're lost, we have the opportunity to see our consciousness is built on a sense of self, of separation. It's a chance to see our labeling and our concepts, a chance to see how we grasp at the concepts or the labels or the objects we like and push away the others. We have a chance to see how we relate to ourselves and our thoughts with acceptance or with a sense of failure or criticism. Then with even deeper mindfulness, deeper meditation, deeper noticing, we have a chance to see through all of this, to see it all as something that is optional. Everything that we add, all of our interpretations and reactions, totally optional. And the opposite of helpful. So eventually we can see all of this unhelpful activity that we do routinely, labeling, judging, grasping, pushing away, judging, criticizing. We see the formation of samsara, the inevitable suffering of this self-centered behavior. Meditation is designed to slowly refine our perceptions and liberate from this conditioned behavior that guarantees the unsatisfactory nature of our existence. So with that introduction, go back to noticing the physical aspect of settling. Feel wherever your body, feet, legs, butt, back, head are being supported by the earth, directly or indirectly. Notice the sense of weight, the sense of solidity. Notice the sensation of your skin, the movement of your breath, whether your eyes are open or closed, the perception of light and dark. Notice the breathing in and breathing out, the movement of your body, the sense of nourishment with the in-breath, the sense of relief and release with the out-breath. And focus on a sense of being here now. Be here now. Notice when you're fully present. In body, heart, and mind. Notice when presence falters. Or you're taken completely away. Notice your relationship with whatever took you away. Check to see if there's grasping or pushing away or judging. Let it all go simply. Like a butterfly leaving your open palm, and return to presence. Presence in body, presence in heart, presence in mind. Be here now. That there are subtle differences between individual practice and group practice. And eventually, there's no such thing as individual practice. That whether we're in the same room, or on the same Zoom, or simply occupying the same world, as practitioners meditating, we're supporting each other's meditation. And our attempts to adhere to the form, but even more important than the form, to the goal of being present, the more we support each other in this work. And the more we open each other to this opportunity, the energy of meditation and the attitude of meditation and any insights that have arisen in meditation into the room, into this Zoom meeting, into this gathering of pictures on the wall, our goal is not to have 20 or 30 minutes a day of meditation and then leave meditation behind. Our goal is for our periods of meditation to develop in a way that they can be brought into our daily life. So one of the most important parts of meditation is taking what we learn on the road. Taking who we become in meditation on the road. Allowing meditation to refine what we are and how we move in the world. And if you feel like standing up and stretching or getting something to drink, this is a good time to do it. But as you move around, try not to leave meditation on the cushion, literally or figuratively. But as you end a meditation session, try to practice in whatever way you can, bringing meditation into your activity and into your perceptions. And even into your sense of who and what you are. When we start on the Dharma, meditation is kind of something to do which we don't usually find very pleasant. It's more of a chore. And it's something we can check off on the day's activity lists and then go on about our business. And let's try to change that. And bring meditation more and more fully into our life. So obviously we're not talking about the kind of meditation that people do in caves. And we're not talking about the kind of meditation which focuses on concentration. Concentration is certainly an advantage as it arises naturally, but actually, for most of us, myself included, the best meditation is problem meditation. The best meditation for transformation, in my experience, is the meditation mistakes, the meditation errors, the meditation distractions. And our reactions to those. Without problem meditation, some of us, like me, we'd have a very hard time with the Dharma. So, to back up now, we've been talking for some time about practice, making a differentiation between practice and teachings. I think most of you have been with us during those talks, but in general, people often mistake practice and teaching. Except for maybe one person a century, teachings don't liberate us. Teachings do not set us free. Teachings do not break the bonds of samsara, which has to do with our sense of being a separate self and all of the suffering that comes from that. Teachings point the way to various ways of looking at that suffering, looking at reality, and various practices for helping us refine our perceptions so that we can slowly become free of that suffering. So teachings are like a map. Maps don't get us to where we're going, except indirectly. The way we get to where we're going is we walk or ride. We get there one way or another with effort. Pat sent me a wonderful quote from a book by Robert Aitken, a Zen teacher. Marvelous person, now deceased. who he wrote a book called Zen Master Raven, more of a pamphlet. Raven is a Zen teacher and a group of animals around him, his students. And the story Pat sent me recently was one called The Goal. The Goal. Grey Wolf made one of his rare visits to the circle. And after the talk by Raven, he remarked, "The goal of practice seems to be just more practice." And Raven bobbed her head and said, "Well, sounds like a Zen teacher." Grey Wolf hesitated and then asked, "So there's no end to it?" Referring to practice. Raven hopped down from the perch to a little hummock beside Grey Wolf, put her beak to his ear and murmured, "Thank goodness. Thank goodness there's no end to practice." So that would be hard to understand when we first meet meditation practice. We can't wait for each session to end. But what is being pointed out here is that slowly practice becomes being, seamless. The presence and the perception that we develop in practice becomes what we are in relation to ourselves and the rest of our life. That's why Raven said, "Thank goodness it's endless." Now, my own interjection here is that what we think of at practice at the beginning does come to an end. It transforms. Practice seems effortful in our early years of practice, and it seems effortful on some days even after we've been practicing a long time. But slowly and perceptibly, alchemically, it becomes us. Another quote, T.S. Eliot, one of my favorite poets, in his collection called The Four Quartets, wrote, "We shall not cease from exploration. And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we began and know it, know this place for the first time." Practice is like that. You could say we shall not cease from practice. And at the end of all our practicing, we arrive where we began and know it for the first time. Practice transforms us. Marina recently guided the Wisdom Circle on the Paramitas. I understand it was very well received. And the Paramitas are a collection of practices. That guide us, they're a form of practice as we integrate them into our life. And before that, I forget who led us in reviewing the four thoughts. But the four thoughts are another practice where every day, hopefully throughout the day in various informal ways, we can contemplate these four contemplations that are known to turn the mind towards the Dharma and to transform us. And we're focusing on impermanence tonight as our collection of practices. And the first two of the four thoughts point us toward an understanding of impermanence. The first thought has to do with our fortunate circumstances. basically, I'm aware of these rare and fortunate circumstances that allow me to practice the Dharma and to work on refining my perceptions. And the second thought is contemplating the inevitability of change and of death. Now, you would think clearly the second thought is the one about impermanence. But the first thought, our fortunate circumstances, is emphasized in the teachings with a story about a world that is only water, a world the size of our world, but it's only water, no land. And on that water floats a wreath about this big of woven flowers. And there is a blind tortoise swimming in this ocean underwater. Once every 100 years, he comes to the surface randomly, pokes his head out, takes a few breaths, looks around, and goes back down for another 100 years. And the teaching is that the frequency with which he randomly comes up and his head pokes through that floating wreath is the frequency at which human beings have the favorable circumstances that allow them to practice the Dharma. This teaching is emphasized in certain traditions heavily, that these circumstances that each of us tonight take for granted, that allow the study and practice of the Dharma and the work of transformation, are so rare as to be equal to the number of times that tortoise randomly comes up every 100 years with his head poking through that wreath. So these are precious circumstances beyond any imagining of those of us who have a life privileged in other ways as well. And then the second thought reminds us of the inevitability of change and of death. These circumstances are very temporary and are going away as we speak. So the first two thoughts have us humbled. We're humbled by the amazing generosity of fate that gives us these circumstances that allow us to practice. And the second thought says, pay attention, because they're going away even as they appear. Make every moment count. This is why we practice presence. This is why mindfulness is the base of all Dharma practice. The teaching that goes along with the second thought, the inevitability of change and death, in some traditions is the quote, it's a line in a poem actually, certain that I will suffer in turn. And the line that follows that is, I continue to practice the Supreme Dharma, certain that I will suffer in turn. May I continue to practice the Supreme Dharma. Very old traditional poem. So by contemplating the certainty that I will suffer in turn, meaning that even while we're still alive, even while we have these fortunate circumstances, suffering is inevitable. It hones our perceptions in a completely kind of alchemical way. And it changes our ordinary consciousness. And all I can say is it's kind of an alchemical process, but it depends on keeping these thoughts in mind. These amazingly rare, precious circumstances and the certainty of suffering, the certainty of these circumstances going away. Now, just as a review, we've learned that there are two simultaneous truths about each of our existences, our existence. One is our ordinary consciousness, called ordinary mind or conditioned consciousness or egoic mind. It's the consciousness of deluded perception, the perception of an I-me mind, the perception of being separate. And this conditioned consciousness is the root of all suffering, but in Buddhism is called samsara. To the degree we are separate, and I won't go through all of the numerous pages of proof but that guarantees our suffering, or more accurately, the unsatisfactory nature of life. So that's one truth. It's with us all the time, our ordinary consciousness, our conditioned perceptions. And simultaneously, there is awakening mind, which we are cultivating tonight and throughout our life in the Dharma. We're cultivating awakening mind. We're moving into a position where we can start to see ordinary mind rather than just be trapped by it. We're refining our perceptions. Refining our perceptions amounts to developing the view. And we refer to the view again and again and again. It's called the view of emptiness, but emptiness is a horrible word. It's the view of wisdom. It's the view of seeing that things are not as they appear to be. It's through cultivating the view, we see that ordinary conditioned appearances are false. For one thing, it's not separate from me. I am not separate from it, whatever it is. Things are not as they appear to be. Rather, they are impermanent, interdependent, or interdependently co-arising, or mutually co-arising, or numerous terms. Everything is influencing and becoming and changing everything else, which has a lot to do with oneness. And everything is free of all that we add due to our conditioning. All of our likes and dislikes and preferences and graspings and pushings away. The view teaches us that things are separate from that, free of it. Things are impermanent, things are interdependent. So for the next 3 months, starting now, we're going to focus on each of these topics as practice. So tonight we're focusing on cultivating our view through practices that are related to impermanence. We're focusing tonight on impermanence. It's random. We could have focused on the other two, but one of the reasons we're choosing impermanence is that the Buddha and my own heart teacher felt that impermanence was the most open gateway for most people to cultivate view. View being cultivating perception of the truth of things. So in honor of the Buddha and my heart teacher, we're starting with impermanence as our practice focus for the next month. And how we can form daily practices around impermanence that bring awareness of impermanence into our daily life, into our daily hours, into our daily minutes. Become married to impermanence in your practice, because indeed you are, whether you like it or not, we are all married moment by moment to the truth of impermanence. Now, everybody knows about impermanence intellectually. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna said to Arjuna, "Arjuna, you know what is the most wondrous thing of all?" Arjuna said, "No, Lord, what is that?" Krishna said, "All men know that they will die, but no man believes truly that he will die." He left women out, so women might have this pegged better than men do, but this is the quote from Krishna: "All men know that they will die, that no man believes, truly, truly believes that he will die. Part of impermanence is change. We all fear change in many deeply conditioned ways, and yet we say things like, I can't wait for this day to be over. Talk about irony. We fear change, and we can't wait for this day to be over. So, as usual, this is an example of how everything is the teacher. And the worse the thing is from a Dharma perspective, the better the teacher. So in this case, we're seeing that we're pushing something away rather than the Dharma alternative of simply being with what is, noticing that it's unpleasant, or we wouldn't have said that. But from a Dharma perspective, pleasant arises, unpleasant arises, neutral arises. Eventually, we can just notice. Impermanence is not something that's going to happen. Death is a relatively dramatic example of impermanence, but we are dying and living and being reformed, actually, physically, moment by moment. So birth and death are occurring in our body moment by moment. So, Bob Carlson and I and Wendy and Carol were reading a book called Being Mortal by Atul Gawande, a brilliant physician, talking about aging and death. And Bob was dealing with prostate cancer at that time. And I asked for his opinion about the book and how it was affecting his perception of things. And Wendy has given me permission to read this little note to you. This is Bob in 2015. Our culture's conditioning doesn't understand the law of impermanence as a real law of nature. Thus, staying alive is seen as a battle, a war to survive against death, the enemy. Thus, letting go, surrendering, is seen as a personal defeat, a personal failure. We don't see ourselves as part of nature, in accord with nature. Only that nature is to be overcome, fixed, and changed. Thus, our cultural hero's battle is to the end, at all costs, and with total suffering, since the point in the battle where more harm than good is occurring is lost in confusion. Just as only a few understand awareness as who they are, so too the majority cannot understand awareness in death as who they are and remain afraid. Doctors cannot properly discuss death as long as they see it as the enemy to be defeated and are afraid they will be shunned or misunderstood if they don't keep the battle going. And then he says, such fun we are having with this. Wendy, are you unmuted, or can you unmute?
There. I can speak now, I think. Yeah. Thank you, Terry. That was fun to hear his words again, spoken by you.
Oh, I was one of many who loved Bob. But I want to ask your permission to quote a couple things from the email you sent me today.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. Is that okay?
Yes. Yes.
Wendy just said some wonderful things, which taught me, and I want to share them with you. Wendy wrote, quote, don't know mind, the mind that doesn't know, makes it possible to get out of bed in the morning, allows activity. Impermanence is a teaching that comes to us from all sides and can comfort us in every aspect of our lives right now. Just naming all the aspects of our lives that we took for granted 9 months ago that are no more can bring the concept home, let alone let the world's death rate and suffering be realized without the knowledge and the teachings to carry it. So Wendy is first giving us a wisdom teaching about impermanence, and then she's showing us how compassion is the flip side of wisdom, where she's just saying, let alone let the world's death rate and suffering be realized without the knowledge and the teachings to carry it. In other words, she is showing tremendous compassion for the people who do not have what we contemplate in the first thought, is these amazing, fortunate circumstances that the Dharma gives us to not only notice the suffering, but to know how to hold it. As an aside, many smart people at times like these become so overwhelmed that they sink into despair. Easy to see. Carol, who grew up with a very methodical and classical Catholic education, tells me that despair is the only sin which is unforgivable. That got my attention. How can a sin be unforgivable, especially despair? And she said the teaching is that despair is such a kind of arrogance, because in despair, we absolutely have an idea that we know what's going to happen, and that's what we're despairing over. And that arrogance of certainty of knowing what's going to happen locks the doors and doesn't let the grace of healing get in. I found that fascinating. Despair is an unforgivable arrogance that thinks it knows everything.
Yeah.
So I quoted an author that I like some months ago, where she also just in passing said, do your best in everything that comes up and beware despair at all costs. And this kind of underscores why. Despair in that arrogance of knowing what's going to happen totally denies impermanence, that maybe something different will happen. Maybe you won't feel so bad. Maybe circumstances will change. In fact, the certainty that they will. Another way we meet with impermanence is arguing with what is. You might remember that Ajahshanti said that all suffering arises from arguing with what is. And Carol reflected the other day that arguing with what is actually very protective of the ego, because it allows it to not be in the moment. Because being in the moment makes us feel too vulnerable. So through arguing with what is, we go to the future or the past. The whole topic of global warming is the way the world is relating to it, a great example of how we think impermanence is something that's going to happen. Future. So when asked to summarize all the Dharma teachings, Suzuki Roshi said two words: everything changes. I would like your help now. There's 14 of us, I think. Is that right, Warren?
15 plus me.
And there's two. There's Lynn and Eric. Is Lynn there, Eric? Yeah, and Rod and Marina are two.
Oh, great. Okay, so there's 16 or 17 without me. So let's break into four groups. Can you do that, Warren?
I can do that.
People who are already two to a camera would certainly be in one group.
Okay.
So there might be a group with five in it. But I'd like to have you break into small groups for just a few minutes and take the subject of impermanence as a subject for focusing daily, hourly, moment by moment practices on. So the question is, what practices, what sayings or slogans or visualizations or anything else, what can you come up with that would be a reminder and a contemplation throughout the day to help you practice penetrating the truth of impermanence, practice bringing the truth of impermanence into front and center, into your view of everything? How can you bring impermanence into your moment by moment view? So let's take 10 minutes or so and I'll ask you, maybe not even 10 minutes, but I'll ask you to use your small group to come up with thoughts about what kinds of practices, contemplations, slogans, sayings, visualizations, responses to what's happening. Sky is the limit. I'm asking you to come up with practice guidelines for how to incorporate the truth of impermanence, the view of impermanence into our daily life.
Okay, here we go. Okay.
Join our group.
Hi, Warren.
Hi, Warren.
I was thinking Rick's here. He could have been in our group too. Oh, Shannon.
Well,
wait till Shannon gets
up. What?
Shannon, we're waiting for Shannon.
Oh.
Oops, what happened?
Warren, can you hear me? I can't hear you.
I can hear you, Terry.
I can hear you.
You know, in the time that we turned off, I think, Rick, your idea was best. If one person in each group can summarize the insights of all three or four, that might maximize our ability to hear everybody's contribution. Given time constraints.
It's good.
I'll do the best I can.
Pat, you're muted.
I was just waving to Kathleen.
Oh. Silently.
Let's see, are we all back? No, 14 so far. We're missing two, 15.
Missing three. One more.
We had 16.
Oh, that's right. I'm thinking 18, Warren, sorry.
Sharon was having some problems with her computer.
Oh, Sharon's gone again? Oh, okay. Okay, so I think what we've decided is that one person from each group is delegated to kind of summarize or to highlight a few points that were brought up in their group.
Or all the points.
Is that right, Terry?
Yeah, it'd be wonderful to have everybody's points shared with the group. And if we have one person from each group sharing those points, we might make it so it doesn't stretch out too long.
Right, right. And Rick has volunteered to start, I think.
I wasn't aware of that. I'm going to take and summarize three people's input, since Terry was in our group and he didn't want to participate. One of the discussions was our expectations of what normal is day by day not changing, and how that totally gets upset by grief and kind of kicks you off your path and forces you to realize the impermanence of things. One of the other was a discussion of, and you know this didn't come from me, was a perspective that age gives you. when you're young, it's difficult to contemplate or see the changes, but at Warren's age, it's easy to see the changes. And the third one was that the more that you recognize, practice, think about impermanence, the more you think about and practice impermanence, and the more opportunities come up for you to perceive impermanence and the changes that are taking place around you all the time.
Thank you, Rick.
You're welcome.
Okay, is there a representative from another group that would like to share? I'll have to pick.
No, Carol.
Carol.
Well, I can, except my memory, I wasn't taking notes, and I don't really remember.
Yeah.
That's impermanence personified.
Great example.
So one of us, and then another also had the same app called We Croak, which is an app that gives you a little notification several times, maybe 7 to 10 times a day. And there's always a quote with it. And just even if you don't read the quote, and the quote is about impermanence. And if even if you don't read the quote, just hearing the little notification bell kind of stops you and you remember just as you hear it. It's kind of like somebody just coming up and ringing a meditation hall bell, just pause and remember. And we mentioned watching pain, because when you're in pain, you can't not be aware of it. And once you're aware of it, you see it change. You can also see your mind becoming hopeful that, oh, I think it's better. Oh, darn, now it isn't. And just using your own kind of pain as a awareness of impermanence. And I'd like, Irene, would you remind me of one that I'm forgetting quickly?
Going through doors. That was somebody reminded us about touching the door.
Oh, that's right, right. And how Frank used going through thresholds during his day to be reminded of transition and impermanence. Thank you.
Thank you. Great ones.
Wendy, you should speak for our group.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Oh, yeah, Mary Jo. Well, short-term memory is also a problem of mine. But, yeah, I think it came that people talked about the trouble that they were realizing in their world. There was something bothering them. And they began to realize that the unsatisfactoriness of these aspects. And one person was very gentle with herself and watching what was happening. And then there's me that going around, you know, chanting the right thing, but emanating totally a different thing. All this in purpose, all this problem was a self. And it's like, oh, I have such a problem with self here. I better sit back and look at this and handle it gently, gently. Rod as well realized that you just have to handle it gently. You have to be kind to yourself and kind to those around you who are not aware of impermanence. They're thinking that they're right and it's always going to be this way. And so that was the gist of all of our, Marina was right there with the second thought, is that impermanence is a great gift if we can only use it gently upon ourselves and our neighbors would be good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I just add, I was in that group and I loved what Mary Jo said about how changes brought about by coronavirus have got impermanence right up in our faces. But she talked about a feeling of, sort of lightness of, because of realizing you just have to let go of, you know. Mary Jo, you said it really well. You should just say it again.
Yeah.
But, it was quite lovely because she really conveyed that well. Okay, you can talk now.
I think it's surrendering to the impermanence of everything that you thought was your life, you know, your routines, whatever, and how all those have changed. And you just have to surrender to the moment because it's just really unknown at this time, I think. Something to that effect. I don't know what I said.
No, that was very good. That mm-hmm. was excellent.
Any other points that we haven't had a moment to touch on? Well, thank you all so much. We teach each other. You taught me with this exercise and what you came up with. That last reflection, Mary Jo, reminds me of teachings that I've heard. I think Ajahn Shanti, among the teachers who use the term dancing with life. Coronavirus, my daughter's high school students, sophomores mainly, have now taken to calling it the Rona. Everything's different with the Rona. But coronavirus has been an amazingly powerful teacher regarding impermanence. A teacher that hits all of the points that Mary Jo just went over. What we thought was normal, what we thought was routine, what we thought we could expect. It was all false anyway, but most people aren't so lucky as to have that falsehood so clearly eliminated as the Rona has allowed us to be. Thus, it becomes a powerful Dharma teacher. Not just about impermanence, but gives us a fair shot at compassion as well. This is a brilliant example. You all have come up with brilliant examples of how one brings practice into daily life. Perhaps over the month, as you connect with Dharma members who weren't able to be here tonight, you could share some of this, that our aspiration for this month is to see how many moments of every day we can become aware of impermanence and how many little ways we can trick ourselves into being aware of impermanence. That's the beauty of the thresholds. One teacher talked about using stairways, rising up out of ignorance into awareness of what is, descending from self-clinging into the reality of what is, going through doorways. With each bite of food, there's a brilliant possibility to look at impermanence. Impermanence is one of the hallmarks of the teachings of emptiness. And a very brilliant woman who teaches the Dharma, whose name I'm forgetting right now, but she's been an amazing teacher of mine. She said, she reminded us that advanced practitioners experience emptiness as fullness. And in some of these reflections you all have shared tonight, you can see how that works, the impermanence aspect of emptiness. Gives us this sense of fullness. It's everything arising and changing and going away like fireworks or like fast motion pictures of flowers unfurling and changing, going away. Our lives like those flowers. Vast fullness, inclusive of everything. And so hence you can see how these teachings on something that seems so weird as impermanence, then we can see it's pointing us toward the fullness of the principles of emptiness, the view. And then you can see how that's actually leading us to this sense of oneness with everything, because everything is part of this dance, part of this great unfolding and changing and going away. The teachings are truly like a fractal. Any single tiny little point reflects everything else in the teachings. So it's good when I can remember to adhere to another important practice, which is to recognize our gratitude for the preciousness of what has just happened, in this gathering where we can come together and share the Dharma and our experience with it, and to teach each other ways of deepening that. Great gratitude for this opportunity. And with gratitude comes the aspiration that somehow we can use what we've experienced here tonight and the experience of these practices in transforming us. May we use this magic to benefit other beings and relieve suffering in whatever way we can. And then let's have a moment of silence to let that just settle into us. Great gratitude to each of you for participating in this dance. That teacher's name is Sarah Harding, just came to me. Brilliant. But she, I was a fairly new student, struggling, beating my head against the wall with this concept of emptiness when she said, experienced practitioners experience it as fullness. And that started to open the door. I love you all and look forward to our next meeting.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Terry. Yes. Thanks, everyone.
Be well, Terry. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Warren.
As always, if questions, please don't hesitate to write me.
Thank you, Warren.
Thanks,
Warren. Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Be well. Be safe.
Stay well. Stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Press the button.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Goodbye. Bye, Rick.
Goodbye.
Bye.